Hello, everyone. This is Volts for March 8th, 2024. Industrial policy, what it is, how Biden's doing it, and how it could be done better. I'm your host, David Roberts. In case you hadn't heard, neoliberalism is out. Industrial policy, focused government action and investment meant to shape the economy, is in. The Biden administration has been quite explicit about this in high-profile speeches from National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan and National Economic Council Director Brian Deese. It has resolved to take a more active hand in determining which industries grow in the U.S. and where and what kind of jobs are created. I had Deese on Volts last February to walk through the administration's thinking. But there is a lot more to say about industrial policy and how Biden is doing it. The Roosevelt Institute has just published a package of essays exploring what works in industrial policy and how the U.S. could improve its efforts. So I got in touch with Todd Tucker, the political scientist who leads Roosevelt's work on the subject. We talked about what industrial policy is and why it's needed, and then got into Biden's particular version of it, how it stands up to various criticisms, and what might be done to improve it if Biden gets a second chance. This one is a bit nerdy, but it will give you tons to think about. All right, then, with no further ado, Todd Tucker of the Roosevelt Institute, welcome to Volts. Thank you so much for coming.
Thanks so much for having me. Huge fan. Glad to be on.
So we're here today to talk about the subject of the hour. It's on everyone's tongue, industrial policy. Loyal Volts listeners will recall that we had Brian Deese on last year from the administration, from the Biden administration, talking about sort of like how the administration envisions its own industrial policy, what it's trying to do and why. But I thought, since everybody's talking about it and since there's a lot of discussion these days about kind of what's missing and what could come next, I thought it'd be nice to step back and kind of get a little more of an overview of the subject, dig a little bit more into what Biden's looks like and what, you know, a better or next version could look like. And the Roosevelt Institute just had this series of essays on this. And this is something you cover as a political scientist. So with all that preamble out of the way, maybe let's just start by defining industrial policy. What do we mean when we talk about industrial policy?
Yeah, sure. You know, industrial policy is a lot like economic development and the way that those things get kind of debated in the faculty lounges of various universities, which is that, you know, for as many people as write or think about it, you probably have just about as many definitions of what it is.
We should make that clear that there is no such thing as exactly what it means. Everybody means a little bit something different. So just give us your sort of best go at it.
Yeah, everybody means something a little bit different. I mean, there's some very narrow and some very broad definitions. So right. I'll just canvas those for a second before pivoting to my favorite definition. And of course, I'm right and everybody else is wrong. But
Course, that's why I'm having you on.
But, you know, I think that there are some folks that treat industrial policy very broadly as essentially a synonym for economic policy. So you have some political scientists and economists that sort of say any kind of government intervention at all could be considered as industrial policy. You have other folks that go very narrow and they sort of say, if it's not a toolkit like a subsidy or a tariff, then it's not industrial policy. Or that industrial policy only has to do with heavy industry and sort of heavy manufacturing, right?
Right.
Those are some of the various definitions out there. You know, I use a different one that I think is becoming more conventionally accepted within economics and social science more generally, which really goes by the intention of the policy. So if the intention of government policy is to change the composition of industries in the economy, then that counts as industrial policy. So essentially, there are industries that we want to see more of. Let's develop those. There are industries we'd like to see less of. Let's wind down those. But it's basically any time the government is not neutral as to which industries are surviving and thriving in the economy, then that can be considered industrial policy.
And a bunch of different kinds of policy could be passed with that kind of intent, you know, sort of tax policy or tariffs, trade policy, you know, foreign policy. There's a lot of different things you could do with altering the character of the industrial base in mind.
That's right. You know, and I think that like an industrial policy is sort of one particular intervention to build up or wind down an industry. And then if you put that in the context of, you know, what's sometimes called planning, industrial planning, or the economist Mariana Mazzucato calls it missions, then that's basically when you have a whole bunch of different industrial strategies that are kind of tied together and working in conjunction to basically smooth out, you know, the transitions between different industries. So, you know, you could imagine having a trade policy that was going to expose either more or less of your economy to competition that might displace people. So then if you have a complementary industrial strategy for the service sector, then that might be a place where you could absorb some of those people that are let go.
Yeah, worth emphasizing this point that it's not just about boosting industries you like. Industrial policy can also involve how to wind down industries that are, you know, on the way out for whatever reason or that you want to shepherd out. Both sides of
that equation. Yep.
So that's industrial policy, basically a policy that's meant to sort of move money and status around among and between industries, you know, elevating some, you know, winding some down, that kind of thing. And we should say, you know, it's funny, I was listening to this NPR piece on industrial policy just a couple of days ago, and they just like were kind of going overboard, I thought, saying that like industrial policy is like the policy that was scared to say its name and like was, you know, shameful in the halls of academia for years and years. And now a few brave iconoclasts are daring to say the words. I'm just like, come on. But it is true, I think, that industrial policy, trying to fiddle with the industrial composition of the economy, was looked down on by mainstream economics for a long time. And probably maybe like in total still is? Like, what's your read on the status of industrial policy in economics?
David, I mean, such a good question. You know, I'm old enough to remember 2019, which is when we were thinking of sort of formally launching an industrial policy program at the Roosevelt Institute. And I can't tell you how many meetings I was in where we were thinking, is the branding of industrial policy so terrible that us sort of stepping in and sort of claiming it as a topic worthy of study and doing policy work around, you know, is that too much of a bad association? And I think that, you know, it's true. Like the U.S. never stopped doing industrial policy. We've always had industrial policy of one kind or another.
Crucial point.
But largely in the defense sector was where a lot of that was focused. So it's true that there wasn't, you know, it wasn't widely accepted that there can or should be an industrial policy for the civilian economy. Like there were certain people in certain niches of government that, you know, quietly used tools to kind of, you know, nudge the industrial composition of the country. But it was not something that was widely accepted. And I think that that kind of gets to, in a way, you know, we've defined what industrial policy is. Let's say a word about what it isn't, kind of with the inverse of it, which is really letting the market decide which industries are going to survive or thrive, right? And that was, of course, the dominant economic paradigm, you know, in the U.S. and globally since the 1970s.
The famed neoliberalism, I believe, is what
the famed
is,
neoliberalism. That's right. You know, and the Washington Consensus, and yes, you know, it goes by different names. But I mean, the posture that folks in D.C. definitely had was that it's, you know, government is going to be bad if it tries to direct the industrial composition in the economy. So it shouldn't try to do it.
Yeah.
And so that was sort of the operating code and the philosophy that was dominant for a long time. So to kind of say, no, there actually is a public interest in deciding which industries survive and thrive, and, you know, government is going to step into that role, you know, that was controversial. And I think it's...
And can do so competently.
Can do so competently, and there's good existential reasons in some cases to do it, right? So I think that, you know, even though it's kind of a do what we say, not what we do kind of thing. you know, the posture that Washington was projecting onto the world through its, you know, the World Bank and the IMF and the, you know, World Trade Organization was get government out of the way of making decisions about industry.
Yeah. But I want to emphasize before we go on, and I could I'll try to restrain myself because we could talk about this forever. I could rant about this forever, but I just want to put it on the record before we move on. It is not possible to govern a large, modern, wealthy democracy without industrial policy. It's not really a choice about whether to do it. Like, you always are doing it, and we always have been doing it. And so you see that, like, because it couldn't speak its name in public, because you can't do it above board, because we're all sort of pretending that we're not doing it, it gets shoved into the background and shoved way deep into the tax code where no one notices it, right? And consequently, it's like often very crappy, often ineffective, and often serves the interests of oligarchs. You know what I mean? But it's there. It exists. We're doing industrial policy. So I think it's just like absolutely salutary, absolutely healthy that we're now being honest about the fact that we're doing it and talking publicly about what we want to do with it. Like, it's just the illusion, like any industry that a country really cares about, right? Look at defense. Look at energy. Like, there's no laissez-faire. There's no market deciding in energy. You're not going to let markets decide whether people have energy or not, right? So, like, it always happens when you care about an industry. It's just, there was just this weird orthodoxy, like, we're all supposed to pretend that we're free marketeers. So I just think it's good that we're talking about this. Anyway, I'll leave it there. But so the next thing I want to talk about is sort of, you know, industrial policy, as you've defined it, is very broad, could include a lot of different things. So let's just talk briefly about what Biden's looks like. And we should say, and I should say up front, that like there's what Dems might have want to have done, right? What they might have wanted to do industrial policy wise. And then there's what they were capable of pulling off. So I think it's good to keep those two distinct. But what are the sort of characteristics of Biden's industrial policy?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we can get more, if you're interested in it, the sort of the prehistory of like how Biden came to even, you know, sort of be moving in this direction if you want. But I mean, let's define a little bit about what Biden's doing. So if you go back to 2020, middle of 2020, there was a series of Build Back Better plans that were put out and Made in America plans. And there was a whole bunch, you know, kind of like Elizabeth Warren, there was a lot of plans that started coming out at a given point. And, you know, it was a very heavy dose of industrial policy. They weren't necessarily calling it that at the time, using that phrase. Mm-hmm. And still sometimes they like to use industrial strategy rather than industrial policy, which is fine, whatever, you know. But I think it's important to note, they were not talking about an industrial strategy for absolutely everything in the economy, right? It was a fairly narrow subset of industries, what economists would call upstream industries, right? It's kind of you mentioned energy, but it's like the things that the rest of the economy kind of relies on. Mm-hmm. And that's the focus of Biden's industrial policy. That's the focus of a lot of countries' successful industrial policies, which is focusing, on those things that are inputs into like almost everything else that is produced in the economy. So that is clean energy, that is semiconductors, that is some sectors like steel that are used in a bunch of things, right? That is really where they are focusing their energy. And, you know, they're doing it with a handful of tools. You know, they're not using the entire toolkit that's ever been used domestically or internationally. They're using a sort of certain subset of tools. You mentioned the tax code. A lot of this is going through the tax code. A lot of this is going through the forms of tax credits.
And I should just say, to repeat myself, this is because of the friggin' filibuster. You can't pass normal bills anymore. So everything goes through reconciliation, which means everything goes through the tax code.
Reconciliation forces some, you know, weird design choices and policy, right? At least. But I think, you know, looking at like climate specific policy, there's also other factors, right? Like the Supreme Court being what it is, the Senate being what it is, right? You can imagine a variety of different ways of tackling decarbonization, including things like carbon taxes, including things like regulation. But, you know, we've had a difficult time getting those through our institutions. So on some level, you're kind of left with industrial policy almost by default, even if you don't love the idea, right? Because it really is the thing. It is the tool that you can use to make progress quickly at the size and scale that we need for the climate transition. So, that's kind of the why they've settled on industrial policy. You know, again, if you would have asked me a few years ago, is the U.S. going to do a big industrial policy push? I would have said, you're crazy. You know, I think that we were thinking at Roosevelt that this might be something that gets taken up in 2030 or something, right? But then basically COVID and the climate crisis and a bunch of things sped up the conversation.
It was a lurch. It was very, like, it's continually surprising to me just how quickly industrial policy went from verboten to kind of like everybody's thing.
That's right. That's right. So a couple of different tools that they're using, you know, tax credits, which are not, you know, I agree with you. There's a long history of the U.S. trying to hide the ball through the tax code when it comes to things. But I would say that the tax credits that the administration are doing are different and a little interesting in that there's a lot of different conditions and incentives that are placed sort of embedded within them. You know, some folks call it the layer cake of IRA subsidies, right?
Yes, we're going to touch on that later.
Yeah, the 30% production tax credit or, you know, investment tax credit. If you just make the thing that we want you to make, whether that's, you know, green hydrogen or you know, clean manufacturing, and then you can get additional subsidies if you, you know, pay your workers prevailing wages, if you use domestic content, if you invest in poor communities, right? There's kind of all these ways that you could actually end up getting, depending on the project, potentially up to 70% of the project paid for. So,
well, right. If you can't do just rules and regulations, you end up trying to accomplish everything through the tax code, right? I mean, that's kind of what that's about. Like, you can't, there's no other way to do that stuff. So you have to find some way of attaching it to money.
Yeah. And it's an interesting balance, right? Because, and we can maybe talk about this more, but like, one way of doing this would be to require that companies do all of this stuff to get any money. And then there's kind of a more market-friendly way of doing it, sort of an in-between way of doing it, which sort of says, okay, you company decide whether you want 30% or whether you want 70%. If you want 70%, we're going to ask more of you.
Right.
But otherwise, you can get the 30%. So you figure out if the economics works and then come back to us with a plan, right? So that's the tax credit part of it. You know, that's a similar sort of structure for both IRA and for CHIPS, the semiconductor law. And then there's sort of a second pot of money that, you know, I know you had Jigar Shah on recently that he's in charge of managing, which is the grants and loans out of the loan programs office. And CHIPS office has a similar structure, right? And that's, you know, again, it's sort of not the corporate welfare that you know, one might imagine when you hear about the government writing checks to companies, because it's, you know, there's this competitive process where companies have to kind of come up with a pretty serious proposal on community engagement, on labor engagement, on a lot of different things if they want to get the maximum number of points that they could potentially get.
Yeah, I mean, I should just put this out there, and Jigar would yell at me if I don't. It's just like the process of applying for LPO, for loan programs office loans, is incredibly rigorous. It's like more rigorous than it is to get VC money or any other kind of money. Like, it's incredibly difficult to get through that gauntlet.
Yeah, and yet companies are lining out the door to apply for the money.
Right.
They have, you know, more grants than they can process.
And you could also, I mean, and we're going to touch on this later too, but they're talking about setting up a green bank. I think that's going forward, and that would sort of fall in that second bucket similarly, yes?
That's right, yeah. So the EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, will have a greenhouse gas reduction fund that will be sort of the nation's first, effectively, green bank, that would then sort of pass through projects at the state and local level, and tribal governments and, you know, others can apply for that money. And then there's a lot of state green banks that are already kind of in existence that will be tapping into that money to do projects. And so basically now, you know, we're a year, almost 2 years since these big legislations were passed. And we're starting to sort of see the initial big announcements made about like which projects are getting the money. So that's starting to happen on an almost weekly basis.
Yeah, the Green Bank is just kind of in the process of getting stood up. I mean, one of the many reasons I would like Trump not to win is that I want to see what this Green Bank looks like. I'm very excited for it to get going and get operating, because there's a lot of really successful, I mean, you talk about like, can industrial policy work? There's a lot of great success stories out of those state green banks. I mean, it's a proven model.
That's right. And then just finally to round it out, I mean, there's a whole range of other tools, both demand and supply side tools, the government's using to promote the industries it wants to promote, using things like the Buy Clean initiative, which is a procurement program. There's, you know, tariff and trade tools. So there's a wide range of other tools that are being deployed kind of in support of that core strategy of tax credits, you know, and grants and loans.
Right. Okay, so that's Biden's industrial policy. Let's go through, by way of kind of hashing it over and discussing it a little bit, there, you list four objections to it, and I kind of want to walk through them one at a time just because I think it'll help give more shape to that policy and help us address some of people's questions. So objection number one is, I guess, the simplest, which is just the very conventional economic objection that industrial policy doesn't work, that government is bad at picking winners, and that government inevitably ends up captured by the industries it is trying to encourage, and thus does wasteful spending and just, you know, just sort of conventional, the whole thing doesn't work. And that's mostly, I think, a conservative line. Although I think if you are a lefty, you could look at the unholy nightmare that is the military-industrial complex in this country and kind of find some sympathy with that critique. Like government, you know, like it's nice that government could do good things, but in practice, they're just going to be in hock to big defense developers and big money, and they're not going to do good things. So it'd be better if they didn't try. So, you know, this is a too big an objection to cover in one podcast, probably much less one small part of a podcast. But what's the sort of response to that, which I'm sure is the first thing you run into when you talk about this, when you set up this program, et cetera? Just like, oh, that industrial policy, that doesn't work.
Yeah, that's right. And I think you're right to also note that there's kind of right-leaning versions of this critique and there's left-leaning versions as well. And they kind of end up converging in kind of an interesting way. But, you know, there's kind of two aspects, I would say, to the more libertarian conservative critique of industrial policy. One is basically a critique that government lacks enough information to be able to do the complex planning exercises. So that's often associated with Friedrich Hayek and other libertarian economists.
Very classic old school economist stuff.
Exactly. So that's the information problem, which is, you know, government's never going to know as much as a bunch of dispersed market actors kind of on their own can put together. And basically the price mechanism that all those market actors end up sort of calling into being is sort of the perfect distillation of all the information anybody would need to know about anything, and government's never going to be able to replicate.
The hive mind finds the true price of things.
That's right. And sort of the second version of that argument is, you know, what's sometimes associated with the public choice school of economics or of social science generally, which is basically to sort of analogize government to private actors and sort of say, in the same way that Adam Smith and neoclassical economists tell us that, you know, homo economicus, this is the this interest maximizing, you know, tool, you know, orientation for humans to have, like government's the same. So government is out for its own bottom line, essentially.
Right.
And so if you put government in the room with industry, they will try to be very transactional and like get money for themselves through either more or less severe examples of corruption.
Right, right.
So basically, either way you look at this, whether it's the information problem or sort of the public choice and corruption problem, you know, industrial policy is essentially impossible. You know, like
right, conceptually, which is hilarious to me that, like, I just feel like if you're an economic tradition that concludes that industrial policy is impossible, you're left explaining away, you know, centuries of industrial policy.
That's right. You know, from the rise of China to the rise of the U.S., I mean, there's a lot that you have to black box.
Right. It was all an illusion, or things would have been even better if they hadn't tried industrial policy. Right. I mean, you end up kind of forcing yourself into some weird arguments.
That's right. And that, you know, that's often you sort of see that libertarian argument, right? Which is that, you know, we don't know whether libertarianism will work because it's never been fully tried, right? So, you know, as long as there's some residual government, like we haven't really been running a libertarian experiment, right? So that's, you know, that's kind of the more right-wing version of it. But I will say, you know, since the 70s, I think one of the characteristics of liberalism in the United States, but also abroad, is that certain segments of the left got very skeptical that the government could ever be anything other than a junior partner to business, you know, and that if it tried to get too close to business, it would inevitably be captured. So you know, some of the work by historians like Gary Gersel or Paul Sabin that sort of look at the what we call the Nader tradition, the Ralph Nader tradition in the United States, definitely had its own version of deregulation and skepticism about the viability of industrial policy. And so, you know, whether it's the more libertarian or the more sort of Naderite flavor, there are, you know, it ends up kind of pointing in the same direction, which is the state should probably be trying to do less in a lot of ways when it comes to industry.
Right. So we obviously can't thoroughly answer those objections here, but what's sort of the capsule response to the information problem?
Well, I mean, government collects a lot of information, you know, some would argue that, you know, I know you had Sabil Rahman on, you know, and part of his job was managing the paperwork flow in government. Government has the capacity to actually know quite a lot. And there's, you know, ways that it does that every day through the regulatory process. There's ways that we've done it in the past by using things like the Defense Production Act to like get a lot of information about things that are happening in the economy. So in a way, like if you're looking at solving really complex informational problems, the government's probably the entity in society that's best well situated to try to resolve some of those problems. And I think that it just also it counsels, you know, in its extreme form, the information argument really counsels for there being no government at all.
I know. And for trusting whatever the market does, almost like a friggin' deity, like it must know best. What can we say? You know, what can you do?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's not, I mean, I think there's an absence of a limiting principle to that argument that I think kind of just makes it fairly weak.
One thing I feel like is underappreciated is that you don't always need perfect information, that lots of times kind of a blunt force move in one direction can get you, you know, you can move in the right direction, even if you're slightly off on your target, as long as you're sort of responsive to feedback and willing to tweak along the way. Like, you don't always need perfect information.
That's right. You know, and so, you know, part of the answer to the Hayekian information problem is that there's this thing called market failures, right? There are right. that are very acceptable within the mainstream of economics, right? There are reasons, there are instances where private actors left to their own devices are either going to produce too much of something we don't want or produce too little of something we do want. So this is, you know, called negative externalities or positive externalities, right? Where you're just, you know, I think environmentalists and climate folks are very comfortable and familiar with the idea of the negative externality, because that's the fossil fuel industry writ large, right? I mean, that is like, they are not in the firms that produce in that sector are not internalizing the social cost of their production in the form of emissions. So they therefore government should tax it.
Right. And one other thing to say here is that it might be true that markets collectively have all the kind of proximate short-term information, but I don't see any reason to think that the market, either individuals within it or collectively, are going to be necessarily cognizant of 30-year problems or 50-year problems of things like climate change. You know what I mean? Like, that's just, you know, there's knowledge and there's knowledge.
That's right. Yeah, markets are going to be pretty faulty when it comes to intergenerational equity questions. And I think that that gets to sort of the second question here on, is it impossible for the state to do this in a non-corrupt way, right? And I think that that, like, let's, I don't know, has anybody, like, read any of the stories about, like, WeWork or, you know, crypto industry? I mean, you know, like, there's a lot of selfishness out there, and it strikes me that the vast majority of it and the most quantitatively important part of it is coming from the private sector. So, you know, if you're worried about short-termism or corruption, it seems like there's a lot of that in the private sector. And, you know, I think there's a lot of pretty good civil servants out there.
And there are governments that work well. Like, we can point at them today. Like, they are possible.
That's right. Good government is possible. And so if you accept that good government is possible, then industrial policy could be possible too.
Right. Okay, so we've justified the existence of industrial policy. Let's move on to kind of some more specific kind of charges that get sort of levied at Biden's industrial policy. One, the next one is, and I'm really interested in your response to this. So the next one is, what you want from industrial policy is cheap inputs, basically, to encourage particular industries. And you should be agnostic about where the inputs come from, basically. Like, there's a kind of critique that says you should do an industrial policy, but the sort of, like, supply chain stuff, the sort of insisting that the mining and manufacturing and assembly take place here rather than there in America, rather than in China, is in some sense extraneous to what ought to be the goal of industrial policy. So I'm curious your take on that.
Yeah, it's a thorny question for sure. And I think that there's a lack of a pithy answer that I have, but I'll give it a try. I think that, look, what is the climate crisis challenge? It is a global problem, yes, and it's not going to be resolved by any one country acting on its own. At the same time, the unit of analysis that is doing the policy change is at the nation state level. And so the climate transition has to be acceptable to nation states and to polities within those nation states, to the people, right? And we know from all the science and literature on energy transitions is that these things are extremely disruptive, right? You know, when some industries are being phased out, others are being phased in, there's a lot of distributional impacts that happen when that takes place. And if you don't manage the politics of this stuff well, then you risk political blowback, and then whatever climate tool you thought you were using ends up getting repealed by the next government, right? And that becomes something for the opposition party in whatever country it is to rally around.
Right. So it's essentially a political argument for doing that side of things then.
There's a strong part of it is about managing political coalitions, but then another part of it is about resilience, right? Like we sort of saw from the COVID crisis, what happens when, governments aren't planning to have available supplies from sources they can trust, right? At key moments. So that doesn't mean that you have to onshore or reshore absolutely all production. And in fact, I think that when you look at sectors like solar or whatever, for the foreseeable future, we're going to continue to have China dominating those supply chains.
Yeah, there's no prospect of us taking the whole thing from them.
But maybe we could get to 5% of the market, maybe 10%, maybe with allies 20%, right? That there would be some reserve capacity there, that would be sort of resilient to geopolitical or economic shocks of different kinds.
Right. So if you're going to do industrial policy, you need to bring the domestic audience along, which means you need to let them enjoy some of the manufacturing benefits and some of the supply chain benefits and not just the cheap goods that result. And there's a foreign policy sort of like resilience against having your industrial policy get sandbagged by hostile nations, as we saw earlier this year. A sort of related objection is what you're hearing from Europe, which is that a lot of these rules the U.S. is passing amount to protectionism. Is there a principled distinction between industrial policy and protectionism? Is protectionism just like a negatively freighted word used to describe the same thing? Or how do you think about that relationship?
Well, yeah, you've jumped on a particular bugbear of mine on the trade debate, which is that, you know, when you're talking to trade lawyers and trade economists, everything under the sun gets refracted through what it does or doesn't do for trade, right? So, everything, you either have tariff barriers or you have what's called non-tariff barriers. And it turns out that non-tariff barriers means all government policy.
Yes, I know.
Whether that's consumer protection, labor rights.
Right. Everything is in some sense industrial policy, which means everything is in some sense protectionism, if you sort of interpret it broadly enough. Like, you're affecting imports and exports, you're affecting trade, almost anything you do.
Yeah, I mean, and so China and Europe, definitely after the IRA was passed, complained about it. But I mean, it's important to note that part of the reason the U.S. isn't doing industrial policy is just to catch up with what those countries are already doing. I mean, Europe has a long history of industrial policy. In fact, they're the leading institution in Germany, the KfW, that funds a lot of green energy and green transition stuff over there, was an export of ours from the Marshall Plan, like where we set up a basically FDR New Deal style bank in Germany that's been operating all these years, even long after we got rid of our own. So, Europe was far ahead of the U.S. on a lot of this stuff. China was definitely far ahead of the U.S. with its Made in China 2025 plan, and going back even further, various iterations of industrial policy to try to maximize their own market share in a lot of rising industries. So the U.S. is really just kind of playing catch up And, you know, a lot of European and Asian firms are among those benefiting from the Loans Program Office and other tax credits. So it's not to, this isn't a trade war, right? Like this is, there's a lot of opening here for everybody. And I think that's kind of like where this difference between sort of the positive externality versus negative externality gets us, which is that when it comes to clean energy, the problem is there's not nowhere near enough of it, right? Like we want a lot more of it. Mm-hmm. Trade rules tend to be more interesting and useful, like when you have too much of something on markets, right? And you're basically like, China's producing too much steel and it's getting in the way of our steel, right?
Right.
So let's have a trade, some kind of trade resolution there. Whereas, you know, as Brian Deese is fond of saying, like, you know, there's enough room here for everybody that wants to get in these sectors, and we're very far from a saturation point. So that's, you know, where we're tools like subsidies become super useful. Right.
Every question I ask you today could be a whole pod, but are you worried at all that the World Bank and this sort of international trade structure we've set up, which is very much premised on the idea that sort of protectionism is de facto a bad thing and illegal under some international regimes, is that a threat to Biden's industrial policy, that international regime?
You know, I don't think so for a few reasons. I mean, one is that the U.S., despite, again, sort of sometimes what they say, the U.S. has been quite frustrated with the World Trade Organization since went into effect in 1995.
Seems like everybody's kind of frustrated with it at some point or another.
Yeah. I mean, you know, the battle in Seattle happened in your home turf, yeah, right, in 99. And increasingly what was happening is that members of both political parties were really frustrated with the direction that that agency was taking. And so what happened is during the Obama years, you started basically having kind of a form of what we might call today quiet quitting at the WTO, where basically the U.S. was refusing to they were blocking the addition of additional judges to be on the top court there. And then that got continued under Trump and then got continued under Biden. So right now, the institution still, you know, does a lot of stuff in Geneva. They put out a lot of reports. They have a bunch of meetings. But in terms of, you know, it's no longer the Supreme Court of World Trade the way it was from a lot of the neoliberal era.
Interesting.
So I don't think, you know, does Biden have a foreign policy problem that he needs to spend more time on? Yes, absolutely. But I think that the trade architecture per se is not going to be the place where a lot of those questions get resolved. It'll kind of just be resolved through good old-fashioned diplomacy and cooperation in other ways.
Got it. Okay. Third, moving on to the third objection to Biden industrial policy, which in this one, I think more or less comes from the left. I think the left critique says we are trying through all sorts of baroque and indirect methods to induce or beg or lead the private sector into investing enough into this stuff. And that is just not going to work. And basically, we should be using public money. And there should just be this whole thing should be much more government led and less private sector led. And in this capacity, I want to cite Brett Christopher's book, which maybe you've heard of.
Yep.
Yeah, which basically says, like, the profits coming out of clean energy are not going, they do not match the profits that come out of fossil fuels and never will. And ergo, you're never going to get the private sector to lead this thing on its own. And we should shift the whole focus much more to public money in the public sector. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, so the empirical argument is that firms aren't going to do this. I mean, I think we have some counter evidence, right, of the last few years, which is all of the you know, we're seeing more manufacturing construction than we've seen since the records were being kept.
Yeah, but also some counter evidence, right? Like we've seen offshore wind pulling out of things, and we've seen, you know, maybe EVs not going as fast as we want, or, you know, just like you ultimately can't control the private sector in too fine-grained a way. It's going to do what it's going to do.
So, I agree with a lot of that. So I will, like, sort of allow that's a very important part of the conversation. But I think that, again, sort of the counter evidence is that we've had a 40% increase since CHIPS and IRA,
yeah,
of clean energy investment. There's more manufacturing construction happening than at any point in recent history.
It's wild. Hundreds of billions of dollars flooding.
It's huge. I mean, it's really unprecedented. I mean, you do have to go back to the Eisenhower or Roosevelt years to find anything on this scale, you know? And so there is clearly a lot of private market appetite for this. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's a lot of people out there that think that they will be making profits on some of this. And that's kind of why I think, you know, a lot of this investment is happening. But I will say, like, I think that there's something really to the argument that Biden is too reliant on the private sector in terms of the strategy that they're taking. And I think that you mentioned sort of the case A of that, right, which is what's been happening, disappointing results in offshore wind, which is that we sort of trusted this company, which let's bracket for a minute that it is actually majority owned by a government. Ørsted is majority owned by the Danish government. But setting that aside, you know, we basically trusted this company to kind of make its own projections, write its own contracts, right? Do all these things. And then at the end of the day, like, they didn't have inflation adjustment in their contracts, you know?
Well, and we jacked up interest rates too.
we jacked up interest rates. There was like supply chain problems they hadn't planned for, right? And so in that moment, like, so, you know, instead of these projects being canceled, like, what we could have had with a more robust public sector role is a public bank of some kind, right? Like a Federal Reserve for industry.
Yes.
They could have stepped in with low or no interest financing, right, and made the math work, right? And like, we could have used that same agency to make sure that the steel that you needed or the turbines that you needed were directed to you rather than to some crypto farm, right? Like, you could have done stuff like that. And it is because we've relied so much on the private sector. And granted, I mean, we're giving them really generous subsidies, but, you know, in some cases, because of the economics of it or because of competence issues or because of short-sightedness or, you know, whatever thing might be plaguing any particular project, you know, we're sort of at the mercy of these private actors.
What Brian Deese would say, what he has said publicly, is if you look at, you know, because we just had a couple of reports come out sort of assessing what's happened since this legislation. And what it shows is that roughly there have been, I think it's $6 from the private sector invested for every dollar of government money spent. So, you know, if you listen to Brian Deese, that just shows like our public money is leveraging private money. And I think the sort of counter to this argument that we're discussing would just be like, it's just not practically or politically or economically possible for governments to cough up all of that money. They've got the only pool of capital big enough is the private sector.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an austerity minded person, but I mean, you know, if you tell me that some policy we're going to do is going to free up 5 or 6 times that amount of resources, and I can spend federal resources in other directions on social, social services or something like that, that's pretty appealing. And it might be hard to turn that down. But yeah, so I think that there, you know, there is going to be a private sector role. And I think that, you have to look at what is the right counterfactual. I mean, in the U.S., we have a largely privately owned energy facility. We're not starting, the starting point is not sort of some, you know, totally publicly owned and accountable energy structure. It's something with a lot of private action. And I think that if you look at the sum total of IRA and the other Biden laws, it's going to start to move the direction towards more public ownership through things like, you know, direct pay, which is, you know, allows entities that don't otherwise owe federal tax to get a direct check from the government. So this is going to make it possible for nonprofits, and local governments to actually do more energy production directly themselves.
Yeah. Okay. Fourth objection. The fourth objection was well captured by Ezra Klein as the accusation that Biden encouraged by the left, is indulging in everything bagel liberalism, i.e., we want to boost clean energy, right? And in the instruments we're using to boost clean energy, we're also attaching all these conditions. You have to do it this way, not this way. You have to hire the right kind of people, the right kind of workforce. You have to draw your inputs from the right places. You have to invest in the right types of communities, basically like larding onto our industrial policy all these other goals, all these other social goals, any one of which might be laudable on its own. But if you end up trying to squeeze them all into industrial policy, you're just going to end up with ineffective industrial policy. This is a common critique. There's a whole sort of faction of the left now that's come around to this kind of critique now. What do you make of that?
Well, I think this gets at some of what we said earlier in the conversation, which is the purpose of industrial policy to maximize a given widget, or is it to do economic development, right, for the country as a whole? And I think that, you know, the theory behind Bidenomics is that these energy transitions are incredibly disruptive, and we're a fossil fuel economy, unlike, you know, some of our partners in Europe. So if you're not attentive to some of these distributional trade-offs and have plans in place to deal with them, even if the only thing you care about is the widget maximization of a given factory, even if that's your only thing in life that gets you up in the morning, the longevity of that enterprise is imperiled if you don't have a political strategy and sort of a transition strategy in place. And so that's like where you end up having a lot of these things like labor requirements, like supply chain requirements or incentives, you know. And I think, again, it's notable that, like, despite the apparent length of the number of different conditions or considerations that are being put in place, as we've said several times now, like, companies are lining up to apply for this stuff. And so there's a lot of take up that's out there. And I think if you look at, like, some of the things that government is asking companies and applicants to think about, it's going to look pretty close to, like, the things your C-suite and your board would be asking you about anyway, which is, do you have an HR department? Are you legally allowed to operate in the place where you're trying to do business? Like, you know, what are the HR benefits, right? I mean, it's the kinds of things a smart board would be asking anyway of these investments. And I think you got to think about it kind of from the government's perspective here. If government spending and using public dollars ended up producing a semiconductor factory that was paying substandard wages and was like a sweatshop condition, how long do you think that program would exist? You know, everybody from Bernie Sanders to Donald Trump to Ted Cruz would be campaigning for president on getting rid of those government sweatshop factories, right? So I think for the success, again, just purely for the success of the widget maximization, you want to have this be politically sustainable and seen and admired. You know, and I think that, again, sort of that is the theory here, is that a lot of this money, you know, in the United States, we have this big problem that one of the two major political parties denies that climate change is a problem, right? So how does the U.S. regain international credibility on climate? Well, it does so by putting a lot of jobs and money into every congressional district in the country, so that, you know, even if Marjorie Taylor Greene doesn't agree that climate change is a problem, the solar panel workers in her district, you know, want her to keep the subsidies going. So, yeah. So, you know, I think that, again, it's sort of, this is not just a microeconomic utility maximization kind of challenge. This is, in fact, a broader kind of developmental challenge.
So do you see any force to that critique? Like, does it worry you at all how much is getting put on the bagel?
It's sometimes a kind of difficult to parse argument, because it's sort of saying that as a political or a messaging strategy, government should be ex ante broadcasting the fact that it understands that parts of its coalition, you know, are demanding different things, right? And I think that, you know, until it's clear that, like, a given factor is the factor that's holding up a lot of projects, I think, you know, I haven't seen that the Biden administration is unwilling to, you know, make concessions or sort of change its strategy when something's not working. I mean, you know, I look most closely, or, you know, one example of this is in the solar panel trade space, right? Mm-hmm. Where Biden did something that was, you know, really unprecedented and very unpopular with manufacturing unions, which is sort of, even before the Department of Commerce ruled on whether there was unfair trade, they just said, for the next 2 years, we're suspending collection of tariffs, no matter what the Department of Commerce decides. And so that was very unprecedented. That was very much, you know, upsetting the everything bagel coalitional dynamic, right? But they did it because they have solar deployment goals and they want to meet those. So I think the bigger risk, you know, and Dave Dayan and other people have written about this, is that when it comes to these hard choices, if every time we're making a trade-off, it's against supporting good union jobs in the United States through, you know, making concessions on the supply chain requirements or what have you, that is dangerous. Like, that's actually like, you know, that's dangerous politically. It's also dangerous, you know, just, it's not good equity wise for helping those workers. So I think we have to, you know, trade-offs will emerge and they will be tackled, and hopefully it won't always be on the backs of the working class, I would say.
Yeah. By way of summarizing this before we move on, I guess my reaction is just the idea that you have to do a lot of this stuff to keep your coalition together and to make the industrial policy accepted by the polity makes total sense to me. You know, you hear a lot of this around the permitting debate too. Like, you have to do some amount of community involvement up front or else it just takes longer later. And it's sort of a kind of a parallel argument here, which is like, you have to do some things to make your coalition happy or else all your policy is going to get thrown out. I get that argument on an abstract level. It's just the one thing that bothers me is just like, I feel like we're flopping around in an absence of good like research or empirical data about how much, right? Like, what is the balance between speed and these sort of coalitional concessions? Like, it's, I feel like we're just throwing a dart into the dark, you know, trying to hit the right mark. I mean, maybe Biden's doing too much of it, maybe too little, but like, how do you even know? And like, what's the counterfactual? It's just, it's such a fog.
No, it's a very foggy argument. I mean, I think that the, you know, some of the best social science on this looks at things, you know, like one of the major factors in whether projects go quickly or slowly is government capacity, right? So
yes.
In states and counties that invest more in government capacity, they end up processing all this stuff a lot quicker and you can get things out the door. After the New Deal kind of imploded, we devolved a lot of industrial policy expertise and capacity to the state level. And, you know, some states do really well and other states do pretty poorly. But it's, you know, like California, for all of its reputation as a regulatory behemoth, doesn't have the same kinds of economic development agencies that, you know, South Carolina does, right? So there's there are like some differences in capacity and it doesn't always end up shaking out the way you would think.
Right. I think one thing we could certainly agree on is if you're going to do your industrial policy as an everything bagel, i.e. if you're going to pursue multiple goals at once, you need to attend that with investment in government capacity.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that is a lot of the unfinished business at Build Back Better, frankly, which is that, you know, there were proposals, for instance, the House of Representatives version of the CHIPS and Science Act that would have dramatically expanded government, like the number of full-time employees whose job it was to think about supply chain challenges, right?
So simple.
And that didn't make it through. So there's definitely some unfinished business.
Yes, there. I know. The political system does not sufficiently respect government capacity and state capacity, as is my lonely quest over here in my little corner of the world to try to get people to pay attention to that. Okay, so those are some of the objections that have been flying around. And then I guess you could say that the Roosevelt package of essays amounts to a critique of its own of Biden's industrial policy, which I think you could sort of summarize as it is using an unnecessarily narrow slice of the tools available to do this kind of thing. Is that fair? I mean, it's a very diverse set of essays, but I think that's kind of the theme is like, there are lots more tools on the table here that he could be using.
Yeah, there's tools that are on the cutting room floor of Build Back Better. There's stuff that our trading partners do already that we could be learning from. You know, I think that like, look, I mean, I don't want to minimize the impressive successes of the policies that have happened so far. I mean, like we said, You there's nothing on record as impressive in terms of the manufacturing construction.
With a 50 vote.
Yeah.
50 votes in the friggin' Senate. I mean, not to harp on this again, it's a friggin' miracle that any of it happened.
It's a complete miracle. And I think that, you know, if you and I were around the clock to, you know, the summer of 2022, when it sort of seemed like absolutely nothing was going to happen, yes. Like, you know, I mean, Roosevelt, we were doing papers, which I mean, is actually not irrelevant to the question you just asked, but like, you know, we were doing papers like, what is the maximal thing that the government can do if there's no legislation at all, right? And so we were looking at things like the Defense Production Act and climate emergencies and all sorts of other things that, you know, would have been interesting tools because that was like how sure we were or how suspicious we were that there might not be any bill at all, right? So I think it's very impressive what they've been able to do. And, you know, the results of the, you know, historic results of the midterm election and the fact that, you know, McCarthy and the Republicans came in saying that their number one goal was to gut IRA and roll it back, and then they weren't able to do it. I mean, those are clear indications of some policy and political success there.
Yeah. So one of the kind of critiques or suggestions that I want to spend a minute or two on is about sort of public financial institutions. We mentioned this a little bit earlier. So Biden has the LPO, the Loan Programs Office, which is like has been absolutely revived, like from almost nothing to now, just like billions and billions of dollars flying out the door. And then he's setting up this green bank, this big fund that will, I think, mostly be sending out money to state green banks, but also I think directly funding some projects. So there are some public financing tools on the table, but my sense from the essay is that something grander than that is possible. Like, what do you imagine in terms of public financial institutions?
Yeah. So, I mean, if you look back to the New Deal, which of course contractually at the Roosevelt Institute, we're obligated to do it absolutely everything. So I've got to get my FDR mention in there. The way that the New Deal and the World War II economic mobilization and conversion worked as well as they did was because there was an entity called the Reconstruction Finance Corporation that was set up in 32, greatly expanded over the coming years. And it was a public bank, you know, it had the ability to stand up a bunch of different subsidiaries to develop expertise on different industries, whether that was rubber or whether that was metals, different things, you know, different subsidiaries could be stood up or stood down to fund production of things that we thought were important to make more of, or to convert factories that were making cars to making weapons, right? Like, so all of that takes money. And the Reconstruction Finance Corporation was the place where that money came out. And, you know, talk about everything bagel critique, you know, they used that power to make sure that unions were being recognized in facilities and that, you know, workers were being paid well. And, you know, they used the full power of the government, really, to make sure that that money was being used towards the best and highest public use. And so that was how we did those things. That was like how we financed it, how we governed those things was through that financial toolkit, publicly available, publicly accountable. You know, you're saved from the imperative of making a profit necessarily, which makes you able to take on more risk and do riskier things.
Yes. Yeah. Because we should just say, I'm not telling you anything you don't know, but just to put it plainly, like a lot of the problem here and a lot of the critique of the Brett Christopher's book and of similar books is just that what's needed here is some patient capital that's willing to wait a while and that's willing to accept lower than whatever the sort of market standard returns, right? We need patient, modest, you know, with modest expectations capital. And really the only place to find that kind of capital is public money.
That's right. And I mean, in some industries and at some moments in history for given industries, you need things like, you know, very much the startup part of the capital. And then in other more mature industries, sometimes you just have a project that for whatever reason isn't appealing to Wall Street, right? So having that public capacity and public financing is like a really good thing. It was the thing that made us do the best industrial policy we've ever done, you know, which is from the 30s and 40s. That was how we did it, was through a Federal Reserve for Industry type entity. It was so smart that we exported it to Europe through the Marshall Plan. And now it turns out that, you know, some of the biggest financial players in the global economy are in fact publicly owned. You know, the essay by Sally Almarova from Cornell Law School that we included in this collection, you know, Industrial Policy 2025, Bringing the State Back In Again, you know, looks at Norway, which is, you know, Norway has a sovereign wealth fund that is the single largest shareholder on the planet and has the ability to shape the decisions of firms in all sorts of industries and all sorts of countries. So, you know, this is not something like the Chinese economic model or something extreme like that. This is the kind of thing that our trading partners use to help them solve concrete industrial problems and concrete developmental problems.
So, yeah, I mean, this is something I always think of when I hear about the devastating effect of high interest rates on these investments, like in the investments in offshore wind. I was like, well, like if we really think this is a public priority, we could offer those wind companies public financing at a lower rate. Like we don't, you know, we're just like, we're not slaves to the market here. So I guess I'm wondering how serious of a proposal is this? Like how politically realistic is it to set up a public bank in the US? I mean, when I contemplate the possibility, I just imagine the finance sector, which is extremely powerful here for dumb reasons, absolutely just lighting on fire anybody who mentioned this. Like, do you see this as a realistic option?
Well, it's funny. I've talked to folks in the financial sector about some of these ideas, you know, for the last few years now. And some among them sort of say, you are trying to put us out of business, aren't you, with this idea? The interesting thing is a lot of them would love to work at a place like that, right?
Nah.
They actually think that could be a good thing, like if the public sector had more capacity in that respect.
Please put us out of business.
Put us out. Well, give you know, I'd love to be paid what Federal Reserve economists are paid, which is not chump change, but get to do something exciting and public-minded, right? Like, you know, there are some people that would like to see that. So, like, is it serious? I mean, you know, one answer to that is we've done it before, so we could do it again if we wanted to, right? That's kind of the simplest answer. But I think it's also that there are a number of different proposals that are out there in Congress, even, that have bipartisan support.
Postal banking, right, is in that family.
Postal banking,
that,
but then there's also, you know, there was a bill introduced by, I believe, Romney and Chris Coons in last Congress for an industrial finance corporation, IFC. No coincidence that it's pretty close to RFC, right? An industrial finance corporation that would fund a lot of these kinds of projects. And, you know, there's bipartisan buy-in to this. And I think that's kind of gets at one thing that's sort of interesting about how industrial policy is coded relative to some other issue areas, which is that if you're, you know, a Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren type, you hear industrial policy and the emphasis goes on the policy, right? That it's a, this is a government and public-minded thing. I think for other folks, more centrist, more Republicans, they like the industrial part of it, right? Like the business side of it. And so I think that like there are ways in which this can be paint, you know, which industrial policy not only can be painted, but truly is something that can help serve capitalism, right? And serve capitalists and be in their best interest because it's the government solving coordination problems or solving financing problems that like any business needs to resolve in order to get up and get going. So I think that it's not as unrealistic as you would think.
Well, and you cite in some of the essays, like we have examples in recent history of industrial policy in other countries that very much served those countries' private sectors, China being the obvious example.
But also Europe. I mean, Europe has all these institutions that were, you know, were making it a green energy, clean energy leader when the US was still on the sidelines, right? So there's a lot of these institutions around the world and, you know, a lot more than you would think. And it makes it, you know, it gives me some confidence that the U.S. could do what almost every other country and trading partner that we interact with is already doing.
Well, my friend Justin wants me to ask, relatedly, you know, the Biden administration seems to have, when it comes to the sort of real economy, right, stuff, manufacturing, embraced industrial policy pretty unabashedly. But when it comes to the aforementioned finance sector, which is problematic for a number of reasons, it seems gun shy. I think, you know, the SEC's in the midst of backing off. I think, you know, there was an effort to force companies to disclose their climate risk that I think they backed off on. Like, it seems like they're not as vigorous in their industrial policy mindedness when it comes to the finance sector as they are for the other parts of the economy. Does that ring true to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think that this is where, you know, industrial policy can be a wind up or a wind down tool. And I think that we're seeing a lot on the wind up side, which is great. We're not seeing as much on the wind down side when it comes to finance, fossil fuels, you know, you name it. There are little hints of progress there. You know, I think Biden's budget from last year that he sent to Congress had things like taxing crypto's energy use. There were some things like that that are kind of would be indications of like where a second term could go and build some power. But I think, you know, it's a bit of a sequencing thing as well, right? Which is that if you read the Financial Times or the Wall Street Journal or, you know, international opinion pages, you'll often see that Biden's policy is all carrots and no sticks, right? That's kind of the rap on it.
Yeah.
And what I would argue is that it's more a sequencing thing of carrots before sticks because it makes the math work better, right?
This is what climate policy learned over the last decade or two, right? Basically, because they tried to do it the other way around.
It's no coincidence that within weeks of the IRA passing, you had California bumping up its phase out of internal combustion engines. You had ideas like the methane fee. You know, you started seeing more serious discussion of carrots once it became, you know, once it didn't seem like a death sentence to be asking corporations to do some of the things we were asking of them.
Here's a question that you're probably in no position to answer, but I don't think anybody else is either. So I might as well ask you, what do you think are the chances that industrial policy as executed by the Biden administration can change the politics of rural America. Because I think, you know, speaking of everything bagel, I think if you talk to administration officials off the record, they will say, quite frankly, like, we're concerned about democracy falling apart and we're desperately trying to funnel money into these areas so they don't just go full fascist. You know what I mean? Like, I think, and I think that's not just America too. Like, I think, you know, the leaders of lots of sort of industrialized democracies are kind of thinking like we have a political problem on our hands and industrial policy is one way to try to address it. Do you think it's an effective way of addressing rural politics or it's going to work?
Yeah, I mean, aren't like farmers marching on Berlin as we speak? I mean, you know, yeah, this is a huge thing. I mean, where it's basically for, you know, 30, 40 years, countries have allowed their industrial and rural heartlands to be hollowed out with nothing to replace it, right? Yeah. So no wonder that people's faith in government is as low as it is in many sectors. And that's before we even get to communities of color and distrust with the you know, government for criminal justice and other reasons. So yeah, there's a lot of, you know, we haven't been doing a good job of giving people in Western democracies a reason to like Western democracies, you know, and so I think that by showing that government can solve problems and can help create jobs and can do so in red districts and blue districts, can do so in the U.S. and in other countries, you know, that is a play to try to shore up the resilience of democracy. You know, Jake Sullivan, the National Security Advisor, gave a big speech at Brookings last year that got a lot of notice.
Yeah.
And, you know, the through line of that speech, I mean, there's a lot of different policy elements and, you know, ideas for international cooperation in a variety of ways. But the through line of it is we're going to build. And by showing we can build, we're going to restore democracy, you know, and it was a pretty audacious and bold argument. You know,
it's audacious. It's a bold effort. But like, here we are like 2 years out and like, hasn't, you know, like,
yeah,
I'm waiting for politics to show some shift.
Well, and this is like where I think that, it, you know, yes, on a day-to-day basis, things can feel pretty dire, especially right. If you spend more time than you should on Twitter or X or wherever.
Who does that?
But, you know, look at the election outcomes, right? You know, the special election outcomes. I'm from Kentucky. Kentucky governor was reelected by running on clean energy stuff. You know, there's been some encouraging signs, and it's not the usual thing you see when an incumbent party has midterm elections, right? Like, yeah. It's actually been really favorable by any kind of relevant historical standard. So I think that, like, it's having some success. I think also, I was at a third way speech that Tim Ryan gave some time ago after his election loss in Ohio Senate, and he was saying, like, we got pretty close with even just the idea that there might be some CHIPS investments in Ohio. Like, we got within, you know,
right.
Shooting distance. And Sherrod Brown in 2024 is going to have a lot better time because there's actually going to be people who are already employed at these places. So I think that, you know, it's some of this is about the Democratic Party trying to have an across the board, across the country political strategy. Some of it's about giving climate goodies and jobs to red districts and red states so they end up being better on climate. So, like, the sum total of it, like, we'll know a lot more after the 2024 races as to whether it actually paid off.
It's so tense because, like, all these investments are just getting there. A lot of these programs are just getting stood up. A lot of the rebates are just going out. Like, it's just not quite going to be up and running as fully as you'd like it to be when this election happens. So, like, you know, like, if we could just get through the election, so much will happen in the 4 years after that. And I just feel much better about it. But I feel like this is like, it's like the election is happening too early in this process for me to feel comfortable about it.
Well, and if you don't, you know, I think that the idea with giving all these goodies to different districts is that it makes it less likely the Republicans will repeal IRA. And I think that, you know, this is a 10-year program. And so, you know, there's a lot of time still, and I don't think he's going to have a way to repeal it that, you know, doesn't get vetoed or that Congress is going to say something about. So I think, like, I feel reasonably confident that this policy regime will be in place in ways that, frankly, I don't for some other, you know, I think if there was a Republican trifecta, you would start to see rollbacks on some of, frankly, the more everything bagel parts of the plan, right? The environmental justice plans, those kind of things, I think are in more danger than the sort of core IRA subsidies.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, just have to insert, there's big question marks there. Like, you know, could be that Palpatine decides to dissolve the Senate and, you know, take absolute power. Like, who knows what could happen?
There are a lot of uncertainties in 2024, for sure.
So many. All right. Well, we need to wrap up. We've gone a little bit over. This has been fascinating. Like, any one corner of this we could do, like I said, a whole episode on. But just, I guess, by way of concluding, you know, in the spirit of this essay collection, what would be your kind of two or three things that you would suggest to the Biden administration to supplement its industrial policy should it get a second term and a Congress capable of doing things, which, as we just noted, is highly, highly uncertain. But if they do, what would you put on their radar in terms of industrial policy?
I would say three things, and I'll give the three things that I feel like are closest in the Overton window sense that they might actually be able to be enacted. You know, I already mentioned the idea of the National Development Bank. Mm-hmm. Like, that is crucial. All of our trading partners have this as an institution. It would have solved the offshore wind problem.
Yeah.
We wouldn't have had that problem. So it's good just on pure market economics terms. That is a reasonable institution to have, you know, one that was contemplated in certain versions of Build Back Better. So this is not a totally crazy idea, and in fact could be quite helpful. I think the second thing is actually, it's a little adjacent to industrial policy, but really important, which is labor law reform, right? Like the PRO Act, right?
Yes.
If you're worried that the CHIPS program office or Jigar Shah, through their individual grant making, is not going to solve the problems of the working men and women of this country through every program that they have to, you know, grant that they have to approve, you're probably right, you know? And so, like, the answer to that, I think, is to, you know, make it so that it's not just the firms that are getting money from the government that have to respect unions, but that any firm operating in the United States has to respect unions, right? And so
it would be real cool.
Intel may like unions, they may hate unions, but if they have to deal with one because their U.S. production requires it, that would be a way to, I think, make the industrial policy proper part of this go smoother and go quicker, is if you didn't have to, like, also solve all of these dense social problems.
And plus Elon Musk's tears would be such sweet recompense.
That's right. And, you know, and there are ways, and, like, we have essays in the report that go through this, but there are ways to sort of pair what's called sectoral bargaining with industrial strategy, which would basically be like, okay, we don't need the electric vehicle companies worrying about whether, you know, one of them or another of them have a better deal with the workers in their facilities. Like, let's just have the same bulk floor and standards across all these firms, right? So I think that would be a way to, you know, solve a bunch of problems at once. And then I think the third thing, you know, which we also get into in the collection, is thinking more about what the public is getting in return for the facilities and the factories that do really well, right? Like, there's no reason that we couldn't replenish the coffers of all of these great programs that we're standing up by having the government share in on the upside, on the equity side, from some of these investments. Again, that's not crazy. That's something a lot of our trading partners do. And it's smart on its own terms because it helps replenish those coffers, but then it also gives the government a little bit more steer, you know, because they'd be a board member essentially, right? A lot of these companies. And that's what France does. That's what Germany does. That's a way, if you're worried about these companies sort of pocketing this money and just running away with it, a way to ensure that is to have a steady hand on the board that the public sector could represent. So I think those would be sort of the top three ideas that I would put forward.
Oh, fantastic. Fantastic. Oh, to live in a world where those things happen. Well, thank you so much, Todd. This is absolutely fascinating stuff. And like I said, like, if we make it through this hell of a year, it will be so interesting to see this stuff unfold over the next 4 years. I mean, just from, like, political science point of view, nothing, never mind, like, your basic, your nationalist American pride and all that and climate and everything else, just learning how these things work and seeing how they work is just going to teach us a lot of fascinating stuff, I think.
That's right. Well, and I think that this is something I tell my students. It's like, because the everything bagel-ness of this means that no two projects are going to look alike. Some are going to use unions, some aren't. Mm. Some are going to use supply chains, some aren't. Like, we're going to have a lot of data to compare to kind of know what things are working, what things aren't. And we're going to have some interesting quasi-natural experiments to study. So, like, there's a lot of cool stuff that comes from the way this is structured some of which can be, you know, make you want to pull your hair out, but in other ways actually will make for really good research projects.
Awesome. All right. On that note, we'll wrap it up. Thanks so much, Todd.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Volts podcast. It is ad-free, powered entirely by listeners like you. If you value conversations like this, please consider becoming a paid Volts subscriber at volts.wtf. Yes, that's volts.wtf, so that I can continue doing this work. Thank you so much, and I'll see you next time.